All right, you guys. Check, check. Welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Got a good show lined up for you today. Thanks to Gage. Back on the job. All right. Today, Eli Clifton is going to be back on the show. Again, writing for Jim Loeb over at the Loeb Log about the billionaires behind United Against Nuclear Iran. Very interesting story here by Eli Clifton at Loeb Log. You can find it in the top headlines at antiwar.com. Also, Mark Thornton is going to be on to talk about economics in China and in Greece. The recent crises there. I hope that I have even got good enough questions to ask him, honestly. I don't know enough about this stuff, but oh, that's a reason to interview him. Learn something. Man, I really should have had breakfast this morning. I'm hungry. Anyway, and David Gibbs is going to be on the show. You guys might have noticed that I got a real hole in my education where the Balkans Wars of the early 90s go. I know quite a bit more about the Kosovo War in 1999. I was paying a lot more attention by then. But let's see, in 93, 94, 95, I was in high school, and I was paying a bit of attention to politics and this and that kind of thing. And I knew that there was American intervention going on over there, but those names just have so many syllables, you know? I never got around to really paying much attention or learning about what was going on in real time in any detail. I mean, I understood that Yugoslavia broke up and the different ethnic factions were killing each other, whatever. And of course, I was always against American intervention there for one reason or another. And honestly, for all the times I've interviewed people about that war, I still never got a very good handle on, you know, really what happened. And so here's this great article called The Srebrenica Precedent, which is about the Srebrenica Massacre, which was, we're now at the 20th anniversary of the Srebrenica Massacre. And, in this article, first of all, he tells a pretty damn good, I think, objective, pretty realistic and highly understandable tale of how this war happened. Oh, you're gonna be just shocked and amazed to find out how much of it was America's fault. Oh, yeah. And, but then he also talks about, you know, the theory that, oh, yeah, you know, if only we'd done more. We gotta intervene in all civil wars. National sovereignty is a thing of the past. We have a responsibility to protect. And all that based on the propaganda. The story of Srebrenica. And you know, it's funny, our friend Roy Gutman from McClatchy Newspapers makes an appearance in here. As many of you know, he published a bunch of war propaganda and hype back then. He's good on Bahrain. You gotta admit it. I don't know what to make of Roy. I like him. You know, he seems almost naive and kind of childish in a way for a guy with so much worldly experience in wars and that kind of thing, you know? Like, oh yeah, yeah, I think, you know, just kind of surface narrative things that he repeats. You know, I'm trying to think of a good example. But, you know, like the whole, the absolutely tissue paper thin story that Assad and the Islamic State get along. Just because the Islamic State is focused on consolidating the territory they've already won, and Assad is focused on defending his government from the people who are actually attacking him. But whenever they do come into contact, what happens? They mercilessly butcher each other. But we're supposed to believe there's some alliance there between the strongest, most ruthless, and dangerous part of the insurgency and the government they're insurging against? No. The real alliance they're covering up there is America's alliance with those Mujahideen, at least de facto. through Saudi, etc. But, oh yeah, I heard that, so let me repeat it. That's kind of Gutman's attitude sometimes. It kills me. But then again, he'll say, yeah, man, check it out. I'm reporting that the Americans killed all these civilians, and no one else is reporting it, but I got my sources, and there's the building, and turns around, does a good job. So, in other words, he does a really lousy job sometimes, reporting bogus war crimes to justify American intervention, and then other times, it's perfectly good. Agendaless. He seems agendaless. I guess that's what I'm trying to get to. He's naive enough to fool on some of these things, but he doesn't seem to just be, you know, a willing tool of the empire in any sense, you know? Like, for example, again, his Bahrain coverage, where America backs the, you know, a very small minority dictatorship there, so we can have our the base for the 5th Fleet station there. Anyway, Roy Gubman, he makes a little cameo in here, not in a good way. But, and yes, it's at Jacobin Mag, and apparently they're all a bunch of commies over there. But you know what? I emailed this article to our friend Neboj Samalich, and I said, hey, man, is this good? Do you like it? And he goes, oh, yeah, this is good, and Gibbs is good. So, you're cool with Malich. Cool with me, man. I'm a Neboj fan. What's the clock say here? Very little time to just babble on the show today. So let me get to some more things here. I guess that'll all wait till next segment. Let me get to these things here. That's not it. Oh, I know. I'm looking in the wrong place. That's why. Oops. You're failing, Seymour. What is it with you and failure? Well, lots of things. I have that clip somewhere, actually. Maybe that's in here.
You're failing! What is it about you and failure?
I told you I had it. All right. What am I looking for here? Oh, yeah. Check it out. Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at the Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1-ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richmond, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks. All right, y'all. So listen, some of you just love the show. I don't really like bragging and boasting and talking that way and whatever. I'll leave all the self-promotion to other people so they can make a decent living. But I do get emails from you people saying that, you know, how much better your life is. You got access to what I got to say. So, for whatever small percentage of you feel that strongly about it, give me your money. Need money. Otherwise, no show. Gotta have money. And so, this is the fun drive. And by the way, it's updated now at scotthorton.org/donate. Derek Sheriff is donating a lifetime subscription to all libertarian audiobooks from listenandthinkaudio.com to the first 3 people who donate $250 to the show. And more. Hang on. Be right back after this. I'll have Charles Goyette's book to give away here in a couple days, too. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really gonna have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. I love this, man. Cop murder passive voice applied now to the Air Force. F-16 and small plane involved in mid-air collision. Oh, really? F-16 crashes into innocent civilian and kills him. That's what you mean to say, right? Oh, involved, huh? F-16 crashes into civilian plane. Jerks. Yes, I know I shouldn't be tweeting live on the radio, but I am. Police passive voice now for USAF2. Great. Okay, good. Screw. Hashtag go die. Okay. Well, you know, the officer's gun discharged and a bullet flew out, hitting the person who was involved in the altercation. Yeah, cop shot somebody. Get it? Yeah, that's how we say it when we're American media. Well, what happened was there was a bullet that was flying out of the gun of a cop who was there, and then the guy got in front of the bullet and hit it. And so, yeah, now he's in the hospital. Boy, you guys are really sophisticated with that, very well thought out propaganda there. I almost can't see right through what you're doing with that. Oh, a small private plane crashed into an F-16, huh? Does anybody believe that? Oh, no. It was 100% the F-16's fault, and so it was involved. They were both involved. Government, those in society, not responsible or accountable to the law. That's the difference between government and the private sector. Right there. No accountability whatsoever. Not even in the so-called private media, which lives only to spin for the state. Anyway. So Obama gave a big speech about the Islamic State yesterday. It wasn't a big speech. It was comments at the end of a press briefing thing by the military. And he just went on about the long war, man. And he says, the war strategy is unchanged. We are facing a generational battle, right? Who believes after 20 years of this, then all the bin Ladenites will be dead? We started out with a couple of dozen of these guys, not enough to fill a pirate ship. There are now 10,000 of them, maybe 50,000 of them or 100,000 of them if you count all the fighters for the Islamic State, which that's a pretty broad definition, but still. Oh, you know what? If we just bomb the Middle East for another 20 years, overthrow the last of our former sock puppet secular dictators, then we'll have peace. Amazing. And then here's the part where I almost can't believe it. I almost can't believe it. He said Assad must go. Again. This is not a rerun. Well, maybe it is a rerun. But if it is, it was originally recorded on July the 7th, 2015. More than 2015 and a half. And Obama... Sorry, my dog is snoring. Oh, shut up. 2015 and a half. And Obama says in Syria, the only way the civil war will end is an inclusive political transition to a new government without Bashar Assad. A government that serves all Syrians. Are you kidding me? You should be asking yourself, Scott Horton, are you kidding me? I don't like that Scott Horton. I think he's a liar. I don't think that could possibly be true. That's crazy talk. What do you mean that Obama says that after they get rid of the secular fascist dictatorship with the led by the guy with the clean-shaven chin and the three-piece suit, that then we will have an inclusive new government that serves all Syrians? No one in the world believes that that's true. That couldn't possibly be true. When Assad is gone, and when the Damascus government is de-botified, you're going to have Sheikh Omar Baku al-Baghdadi, the Caliph Ibrahim, will be ruling Damascus. That's who's going to be ruling Damascus. An inclusive new government. Well, yes, because all the Druze and all the Christians and all the Shiites and all the Alawites, they'll all be dead. All their Sunni accomplices will be all dead with them. And then we'll have the peace of desolation. The Islamic State in its victory. Can you believe this? We are more than a year out from the insurgency that America and its allies has backed in Syria, blowing up in their face so bad. I told you, backdraft, right? It's not even blowback. It's, hey, pour gasoline on a fire. What do you think's going to happen? Open a door to a room that's above fire temperature, full of fuel, but starved of oxygen, and guess what's going to happen? It's going to blow up in your freaking face. And then it did. And now this guy, who's basically might as well be Osama himself, is the declared caliph of all of western Iraq and eastern Syria, the lands formerly known as Iraq and Syria. And more than a year into this, the American president still is saying that the Islamic State's chief enemy in Syria, the secular atheist, basically, dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad must go? And then he just pretends that there will be a new government, an inclusive, a quote, an quote, inclusive. Can you do that? What do when you got to do an A or an and, but you got to use the word quote in the middle before you get to the verb or the noun? There's going to be an inclusive political transition to a new government without Bashar Assad. A government that serves all Syrians. That's the Americans' plan, huh? When Obama a year ago admitted to Thomas Friedman, there's no such thing. That's a fantasy, he said, that we're going to raise up an army that can take on the Islamists and Assad and his Baathist government, backed by Iran, backed by Hezbollah, backed by Russia. That's a fantasy, he said. And where do they get these talking points? Who was it that coined the talking point that the mythical moderates were led by doctors and lawyers and pharmacists? I mean, for Christ's sake, really? Yes, we have all the people with advanced degrees in Syria. They are leading the uprising. Yeah, there goes off another suicide attack. I mean, I don't know. That was never true. Not that people with graduate degrees don't do suicide attacks. Sometimes they do. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. and they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. First up on the show today is our friend Eli Clifton. He used to be with the American Independent News Network, Think Progress, and Interpress Service. Now here he is writing at Loeb Log, our friend Jim Loeb's blog, Loeb Log. Document reveals billionaire backers behind United Against Nuclear Iran. Welcome back to the show, Eli. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. So what's United Against Nuclear Iran?
Well, United Against Nuclear Iran came into existence several years ago, maybe back in 2008. And since then, they've managed a number of campaigns designed to pressure the Obama administration and international negotiators regarding the negotiations around Iran's nuclear program. Now, they've tended to take a pretty hardline position. They were critical of the Joint Plan of Action. And right now, they're running a multi-million dollar television ad campaign designed once again to pressure negotiators, this time in Vienna.
Now, that's where we connect the subject matter right to our audience. Almost everybody, if you watch cable TV news at all, you've seen these ads. This is going to leave Iran nuclear. And they don't say what is the alternative to that, but or even what they mean by that. But they're pretty scary sounding commercials, I guess, if you don't already know the details of the Iranian nuclear program and what the negotiations are about. Are they having much effect? Can you tell? Are the polls out?
Well, I mean, the polling so far has generally shown that that well over 50% of the American public are supportive of, you know, sort of the broad strokes of what a nuclear agreement would look like with Iran. It's worth noting, though, that these advertisements saying that essentially the Obama administration is giving everything away to Iran and letting them have a nuclear program and not standing firm enough in the negotiations are all a little bit odd, considering that none of us at this point really know what's gone on inside the negotiating room because we don't have an agreement yet.
Yeah, well, and their argument isn't, it's only an emotional one and not really a detailed one. It's meant to appeal to the fearful when, you know, their criticism is, oh, he's going to allow them to have a nuclear program. Well, hey, they've got one and they've built it up over all these years, including under Bush years. And there's nothing America could possibly do to get rid of it other than maybe nuke the place and occupy it and tear down every last centrifuge. And since that's not an option, this is what we're dealing with is how to safeguard it even more than before. These kinds of questions. It's impossible, and every serious person knows that it's not negotiable whether Iran is going to have a nuclear program at all at this point.
Well, I mean, I think it's also worth noting that according to certainly to most respected analysts on this, that the best opportunity to constrain the nuclear program and to prevent its growth in ways that the United States and the European allies would like to avoid is actually through an agreement, a negotiated agreement where inspectors can have regular access. And that would all be a great improvement over where we are today,
right,
where that is not the case. We have very little oversight. Inspectors have very little access. And in all likelihood, the agreement, which there's a good chance we'll be seeing later this week, although, of course, you wouldn't want to place bets on that, is going to put greater restraints on Iran's nuclear program than we've ever really seen before.
And, of course, they offered to negotiate back in 2003 with W. Bush, and he probably at that point could have negotiated them right out of even beginning an enrichment program at all. They had no spinning centrifuges whatsoever at that point. And
absolutely
told them to go to hell.
Yeah, I mean, this period of pressure and of sanctions While it sounds good on paper, it's a pretty good interesting case study in how that type of diplomacy can actually backfire against one's long-term objectives, which certainly the reason that, you know, that they brought these sanctions was the idea that this was going to pressure Iran to the negotiating table and to get them to constrain their nuclear program. And perhaps that is true. But over that decade, you know, Iran did install centrifuges. They did expand their capacity. And there's no denying that the situation that we're facing now with Iran's nuclear program is different than where it was a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And arguably, it's much further down the road, and we're not going to be able to dial it back to where it was in 2003.
Right. All right. Now, there's an article by Joe Cirincione, also at the Low Blog from the Plowshares Fund. And he's writing about how most of the experts, seemingly, are behind this deal. They're basically, they make the case that you and I just made. Hey, the most constraints you could ever get on this thing, the most certainty that you could ever have that it's staying a civilian program would be to do this deal. No better way around that. And he goes on and on listing the different groups and experts and former secretaries of state and all these things who are for it. But so now back to who's against it. Is it just the Israel lobby?
Well, United Against Nuclear Iran is previously has tried to portray itself as a wide coalition of groups, and or at least a group that could bring together a coalition of partners to bring pressure on Iran. And to be fair to United Against Nuclear Iran, some of the issues that they've tried to pressure Iran on are ones that do need pressure. We do need civil society talking about, for instance, human rights violations in Iran. However, certainly their criticism of the nuclear deal has been only increasing over the past several months. Now they're spending several million dollars on this ad campaign. And the short answer is, yeah, it's a couple of Republican mega donors, both of whom have ties back to Israel. They both are married to Israeli women, to Israeli wives. And they've both invested a considerable amount of money. I got their donor rolls from 2013, showing that the two people were Sheldon Adelson, alongside of his wife Miriam Adelson, and this silver and precious metals investor named Thomas Kaplan. He's the chairman at the 92nd Street Y here in New York City, and he, along with his wife Daphna Recanati, actually were the biggest donors to United Against Nuclear Iran in 2013.
And so what can you tell us about this Adelson guy?
Well, Adelson is certainly a familiar name. He's certainly the biggest funder of Republican candidates at this point in time. He's also very close with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They are, according to a number of sources, close friends. Adelson has a newspaper, a free newspaper in Israel, which is very supportive of Netanyahu. And in the United States, Adelson certainly, if nobody had heard about him before 2012, they certainly learned about him then when he was the biggest funder behind Newt Gingrich's failed candidacy, which may have actually kneecapped Mitt Romney's candidacy. And Adelson went on to become Mitt Romney's biggest funder. And according to a number of sources, he uses a lot of dark money groups. It's hard to track his money, but it would seem that in the last midterm election, he was the largest donor on the Republican side once again.
Yeah. And now
I should mention he has quite extreme views about Iran. He believes that a good negotiating position is to drop a nuclear weapon on Iran
and then say that
if they don't completely end their nuclear program, the next bomb goes on Tehran.
Wow. And yeah, you know, anybody who really sees that real talent, that real that they're really looking for in Newt Gingrich is somebody that I am suspicious of, you know? Like, here's a guy
moon bases,
who understands me, you know?
We missed our opportunity for moon bases.
Yeah, big problem. Okay, and so, and you know, we know too, there's one more anecdote, if I might add, about him is about how Chris Christie, who meant no offense whatsoever, accidentally referred to the occupied territories as the occupied territories, and they went ahead and put it in the paper about what a huge stink this caused, that he would dare use that language in front of Sheldon Adelson, that later he had to go on bended knee back to the private office of the mob boss. I swear it's like an episode of The Sopranos or something. Has to go back there and get down on one knee and beg apology and forgiveness. I meant disputed territories. I meant, you know, the eternal land of Israel and screw the Palestinians or whatever. I swear I didn't mean to call them occupied. But he was in real trouble for that. And they made it known that Boss Adelson was not pleased with your indiscretion, Governor. I mean, this is some, I don't know, pretty newsworthy stuff to me.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's really worth noticing that with Adelson, it's Adelson. It's Sheldon Adelson and it's Miriam Adelson. Whereas when we talk about the Koch brothers, it's very often the network of donors that they bring together every year.
Yeah. That's an important point. Hey, listen, we're going to pick that up on the other side of this break with the great Eli Clifton right after this. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Talking with Eli Clifton from the Loeb Log, like your earlobe, and then log, like, you know, a tree that fell over. Loeb Log, Jim Loeb's blog. This piece is called Document Reveals Billionaire Backers Behind United Against Nuclear Iran. And unsurprisingly, Sheldon Adelson, Republican gangster extraordinaire, is and Likud Party gangster extraordinaire is one of them. And then, so who's this other guy, a doctor?
Well, he is. He has a doctorate, I believe, in history from Oxford. If I could be wrong, and he sort of made a name for himself as an investor in gold and other precious metals. Kind of his business model is to invest in them when they're still in the ground and then just wait. The idea being that it's, you know, it's a good investment even while it's still in the ground. Now the interesting thing is
that's pretty smart. Governments don't know how to do anything but print money. So buying precious metals is probably always the right thing to do.
And he in some of the mines he owns, he's openly talked in the prospectus, which are open to investors, about how his investments and these holdings in silver or gold are going to be a good investment in light of political unrest in the Middle East. Mm. Or according to a gold mine he had a decade ago, he talked about how it would be an asset that would retain value if there was a nuclear confrontation with Iran or North Korea. Now, all of that seems like a bit of a bizarre conflict of interest for United Against Nuclear Iran when you're being funded by a guy who says that unrest and a nuclear conflagration would somehow be profitable, or at least be something that where his investments would retain value under those circumstances. Mm-hmm. Now, to add a little more intrigue to it, quite a large number of the employees of United Against Nuclear Iran are actually employees of this guy Tom Kaplan's investment companies. So there's a lot of overlap there.
Very interesting. And, yeah, I guess if you were not so politically connected, you might get prosecuted for something like that. It sounds like a kind of a pump-and-dump sort of scam where if you have that much power, I guess – by definition, though, if you have enough power to help create unrest in the Middle East, then you're too powerful to be prosecuted for that kind of thing. But it's,
well,
it's
and when
along
it, when
the com- same lines, though, right, as some kind of fraud.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't know about that. But what I can say is that there's something very interesting that happened with United Against Nuclear Iran this past March. There had been an ongoing lawsuit against United Against Nuclear Iran by this Greek shipping magnate named Victor Restis. Now, Restis claimed that United Against Nuclear Iran had defamed him when they had said that he had that some of his ships had been doing business with Iran. Now, in that suit, when they tried to pursue the discovery phase of the lawsuit, the Justice Department actually stepped in and said to move forward with this private law civil suit between two private parties to which the government was not a part, state secrets might be revealed, mm-hmm. were that to move forward. And they actually persuaded the judge to throw the case out. So we don't know exactly what those state secrets were. Certainly one of the things I've been told by Restis's attorney that they were seeking were these documents showing who was funding United Against Nuclear Iran. But we really don't know what were those state secrets, how did United Against Nuclear Iran have them, and was Tom Kaplan somehow connected to that?
It seems like another possibility, again, just kind of speculation here. I don't know if there's actual information really to back this up, but the group is actually run by a lot of former very high-level people, even from the Obama administration, like Gary Samore, right?
That's right. That's right. He's the former, what was he, weapons and arms control czar or something for the Obama White House.
So it seems like maybe they got some classified documents there as a, you know, on private property that they're not really supposed to have. Maybe that's part of it.
And there are a number of former intelligence officials, both from Europe, from Israel, and from the United States, on the advisory board. So certainly a widely speculated thing that I've certainly heard from a number of people is speculating that they came into possession of some classified documents. Mm-hmm. That would seem possible. I think another area that deserves some scrutiny is not just what documents they got, but what path those documents may have taken, if that's the case. Again, this is all sort of rampant speculation because the judge has said that they can't tell us any more information about what these state secrets might be or why discovery in this private lawsuit, as they say, between two private parties, the government's not a party to this suit, somehow threatened state secrets.
Amazing. Yeah, and as you say, that's unprecedented, right? That's the first time that's ever happened in a federal court that they've.
I believe certainly with providing so little information about what happened, it is.
And, you know, it's only in the 21st century that they've used state secrets to throw out entire cases. Before
right,
that, it was only these documents and those documents, please, Your Honor. But now it's just entire cases get thrown out like this.
Well, and typically these are cases, though, involving the government. For instance, you can't go suing the government if the basis of your case is that, you need in discovery, you need access to documents which are classified. Well, that's going to bring you right up against state secrets and you're going to get that thrown out. But the government is a party to that case. The unique thing about this is that the government wasn't a party to it. And that's what really has, raised the interest of a lot of civil liberties groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, is the fact that the government wasn't a part of this case. And they certainly could have tried to use a more limited interpretation of state secrets to say that certain documents, would be withheld on state secrets grounds. But they persuaded the judge that simply moving forward and even identifying publicly the types of information at play here would disclose state secrets.
And tell us more about this actual case, because that helps, because you think of the group as basically, running ads and trying to scotch the nuclear deal that way, but apparently these guys get real work done.
Well, yeah, I mean, United Against Nuclear Iran over the past several years has expended a lot of their resources on naming and shaming companies which have done business with Iran or in Iran. And some of these have been, a perfectly decent types of pressure to bring. For instance, on crane companies the cranes were being used for executions in Iran, legitimate human rights type things. But where it's often sort of veered off into a little more uncharted territories is when they've gone after U.S. and European companies that have gotten treasury waivers to do business in Iran, selling medicine and food. Pharmaceutical companies have been named and shamed by United Against Nuclear Iran. And these are the types of things where this doesn't fall in line with the existing sanctions. And it seems to violate United Against Nuclear Iran's own statements suggesting that they are not condemning sales of humanitarian products and goods to Iran. Now, obviously, shipping companies become a major point of interest for United Against Nuclear Iran because that's how these products presumably make their way into Iranian markets.
Well, they specifically targeted pharmaceutical companies, huh?
They have. They've gone after a number of pharmaceutical companies on their website. They've listed them as companies doing business in Iran and encouraged people to write to them, urging them to stop doing this business.
Do you know if that's had a specific effect on any of those particular companies?
I don't know, and I would be surprised if it did, seeing as how these are companies that went to the effort of actually getting a number of them got actual explicit waivers from the U.S. government because they wanted to make sure that the trade that they were going to do in Iran fell underneath the humanitarian and medical and food waivers.
Well, and of course, we've heard over the past few years that their medicines is something that has taken a real hit because they import much of their medicine, and even though no medicines are on the banned list of things under the sanctions, that just global corporations don't feel like messing with Iran at all, because who can afford the lawyers to try to tangle with the U.S. Treasury? Do you want to? I don't either. Let's just sell to the Canadians or to whoever instead. And right. So they've had a real problem with chemotherapy and antibiotics and I forget different kinds of drugs, but medicines to prevent hemophiliacs from bleeding to death that are absolutely necessary for them to have surgery for other problems. I mean, people are dying of this.
I mean, what's so surprising here is that these were companies that actually went to the, I'm going to guess, probably extended amount of effort to get explicit waivers from Treasury saying that the trade that they were going to engage in was fully legal under existing sanctions law. Yet United Against Nuclear Iran still had them listed on their website.
This is what they call lawfare, right? We're just
exactly
use every bit of the law, but go to war with it. Doesn't matter whether you're not seeking justice. You're just trying to destroy your enemies.
Although this isn't even a legal attack, this is actually a public diplomacy attack.
Oh, I see.
Companies.
I see. You're just the name and a shame. Now, how many different lawsuits were they involved in? Oh, this is only the other guy was suing them as they weren't suing to make him stop. He's just suing them for naming and shaming him. Was that it?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. He was claiming that it was inaccurate that his ships had been doing business in Iran, and he was suing them for defamation. And he was claiming that rival shipping interests were perhaps behind United Against Nuclear Iran. Coincidentally, this guy, Tom Kaplan's wife, her family, I believe, has ties to a very large rival shipping company.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's an interesting little coincidence there. I don't think they know that term, conflict of interest, in D.C. anymore. I do. We still do. Thanks, Eli. Great talk to you again. Great work.
Thank you very much.
That's Eli Clifton. Y'all, he's at loblog.com. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhortonShow. And thanks, y'all. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute. He is a senior fellow there. That's Mises.org. They got about 10 zillion pages worth of good economics for you to read for free there. Just search around. He is book review editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. His publications include The Economics of Prohibition, Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Quotable Mises, The Bastiat Collection, An Essay on Economic Theory, and The Bastiat Reader. And his bio goes on and on, but we don't have that much time. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Mark?
Hey, Scott, it's great to be back on your show here today.
Very happy to have you on, and we need time because we got two big subjects to tackle here, China and Greece. I think I'm more interested in the China thing, so let's talk about that. Is it the case, then, that their stock market is now in free fall, and just how bad and how fast, and what does it all mean, sir?
Well, Scott, I think you're absolutely right. While the mainstream media is all focused in on Greece, and that's certainly important, nobody's talking about what's going on in China. And their stock market, it's been amazing. It's been an amazing ride. Over the last year, their stock market went from a level of 2,000 to a level over 5,000, a 150% increase. And then over the last 30 days, their stock market has gone from 5,023 down to 3,600 this morning. And it closed at 37.27. So a huge, huge chunk of that Chinese stock market has just evaporated right in front of our eyes.
All right. Now, so We're all Austrians here. That was a necessary correction then, or it wouldn't have happened. Am I right? Or was it a natural disaster, or what?
Well, the Chinese economy has baffled people for many years. It had been experiencing 10% economic growth year after year after year. And if you saw pictures of the Olympics, you saw these amazing modern cities with skyscrapers everywhere around you. But the reality is that China is still partly communist. They still have central planning. And basically what they've been able to do is plan their economic growth. The Chinese Central Committee issues its growth targets to the provinces, and the provinces, in order to meet their growth targets, borrow all the money they want from state-run banks, and then they can use that to build anything that they want, whether that's an international airport or a high-speed rail system or a skyscraper that's over 100 stories out in the middle of the countryside. They can do anything that they want, and so that GDP number stacks up along the lines that the Communist Party has dictated. And so what they've done is they've built all sorts of nonsensical projects. They've built whole cities that could house millions of people that lay empty. They're called the ghost cities of China. And we don't even know how many there are because, of course, they're still pretty secretive and they still keep a wrap on information. But basically, they've artificially increase their GDP by government projects, public projects, infrastructure, all that kind of stuff. And they've increased the amount of debt in the Chinese economy from $2 trillion up to $28 trillion. And so they have massive financial imbalances in the world's most popular, the greatest number of people of any country in the world.
Yeah,
and so that's what's been going on.
Do you say $28 trillion in debt? Now, that's when you, like you do with the U.S., when you count up all the local municipal bonds and the states that are in debt and everybody's credit card and mortgage debt, too? Or
yes.
Okay, so that's the total debt.
That's the total debt.
So we're
that's
not like comparing to America's $18 trillion national debt. That's the total debt. So what's America's total debt in comparison to that, by the way?
Oh, it's much larger, but... And it's gone up significantly over time. But China's has skyrocketed in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. And that's where the financial imbalances come. If you develop debt and capital and wealth over a long period of time, the number can be, you know, super high and not be a problem. But if you do it all very quickly in the short run, and you're not really producing wealth, you're just creating public infrastructure and things like that, then it can be, the financial imbalances can be enormous, and the problems in the real economy can be significant. And so, you know, China is reporting that they're missing their growth targets over the last couple of years, but those are those artificial growth targets. So if you stripped away all of this public in nonprofit spending, the Chinese economy could be in serious difficulties, but we don't know the truth because GDP in this case is really a complete fabrication. It's an imperfect calculation to be sure, even under the best circumstances. But with China, you know that it's been rigged by an enormous. An enormous amount. So their economy is already suffering, and the stock market has corrected by a significant amount. The Chinese government has put stabilizers in place. They've got the big banks to agree to buy stock today and yesterday in order to stabilize the market situation and possibly even allow those financial firms to leverage up their investments in the Chinese stock market in order to stabilize. And so today it appears that the Chinese market is at least temporarily stabilized.
Now, is this when was the last time they had a crash, anything like this?
Well, actually, they've had this before. They had a stock market crash around the year 2000.
But it's been since then. We had, and so did we, But we had another one in 08 was our correction. They haven't had a correction since then?
That's correct. Their stock market languished for a long time, but at the end of 2007, their stock market was around 6,000, and then just a year later, it was down below 2,000. So that's an enormous crash. And then basically their market has been, after a brief recovery in 2009, their market has basically been flat and languishing until about a year ago when their stock market took off from around 2,000. And then in less than, well, in about a year's time, it maxed out last month at over 5,000. And then we've seen this, at least a mini crash. Might expect a little bit of stabilization here, but in the longer run, we've probably seen lower levels in the Chinese stock market because, you know, the types of investments that they've been making are long-term investments. And you know that I follow the skyscraper index and the skyscraper curse.
Right.
And China is just about ready. There's no news announcement yet, but this summer they're going to open the Shanghai Tower, which will be the tallest building in China, and it will be the second tallest building in the world. So it's not an actual skyscraper curse alert, but it's about as close as you can come. And you, as you know, many of the world's largest skyscrapers have opened during a time when their economy was in recession or depression and their stock markets had crashed or were crashing at that time.
Because they were all built at the height of whatever real estate bubble they were in. But it takes that long to open up for business, right?
Then yeah, and this empty. And this one has taken a long time. I mean, this skyscraper was started around 2008. It's taken an enormous amount of time.
All right, now hold it right there. We got to go to break. We're talking with Mark Thornton about China. The good news is they've gone from Marks to Keynes. The bad news is they've gone from Marks to Keynes. Keynes. I never say it right. You know what I mean. Anyway, Mark Thornton, he's a brilliant genius. And when we get back, we're going to talk all about the crisis in Greece, too. So hang tight. Mises.org for Mark Thornton. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. I'm talking with Dr. Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, Mises.org. They are more free market than your free market guys, man, I'm telling you. So we're talking about China and Greece. We're going to switch to Greece in just a second, but I just wanted to mention, and you can elaborate this on you want, Mark, but I wanted to mention, I've read a few different things about these ghost cities in China, and I just wanted to emphasize to people how easy it is to search ghost cities, China, and go find some articles to read about this, and it'll blow your mind. And, I mean, it's just, anything you ever heard about, what the Austrians were trying to get you to understand about what causes the business cycle and the boom and the bust and the seeming good times followed by the inevitable massive crash and correction and bankruptcy of so many. It's like they did this in China as an experiment just to prove how right Mark Thornton is about everything. And, I mean, go and look at, there is no private investor in the whole wide world without a government backer who's going to build a city the size of downtown Houston with nobody in it for nobody who wants it. I mean, this is just unprecedented probably in the history of the world. what they've done over there with this funny money. So, and keep that in mind, too, when everybody's scaremongering about how China's going to conquer the whole world. Not as long as they have an American-style monetary policy, they're not.
Well, you know, Scott, total debt in China, which is national, municipal, and private, has gone from $7 trillion in 2007 to almost $30 trillion now. So that's been an enormous expansion in debt in a very few number of years. In contrast, you know, the United States has racked up tons of debt too, but it's taken us about 40 years to go from almost no debt in total in the economy, just a few trillion dollars, to almost $60 trillion. But that's over a 40-year period. And even though a lot of it is more recent, it pales into comparison to the financial leveraging which has taken place in China since the economic crisis began in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's an interesting story, too. I forget if we've ever spoken about this before, but Lou Rockwell had this great article a few years back called From Death Camp to Civilization. It was when there was all the controversy over tainted toothpaste and children's toys with lead paint and that kind of stuff. And Lou was saying, hey, cut him some slack, and explaining how communism in China, it didn't just, you know, kill 40 million people, which, yeah, it killed 40 million people, but it basically just reduced their entire culture right back down to the dirt. They had to start all over again, only the weird quirk of it is they're starting all over again with late 20th century and now 21st century technology. And so you have this rapid increase in real wealth taking place there when the government finally got, you know, to a great degree out of the way. As you said, you know, Shanghai went from nothing to a megalopolis in 10 years. And you know, I guess a lot of that is phony credit, but a lot of that is just the Chinese people finally being set relatively free to pursue their own ends. And so, I mean, I guess there's got to be some kind of weird distortions here and there, but you're emphasizing that the government intervention in the distortions makes them that much worse. Is that it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm so happy for what's happened to China and the amount of freedom that they have. That's a great thing. And hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty by resorting more to markets and market-like institutions. But you're right, Scott. I mean, they're starting from scratch. And so the norms of behavior, commercial law, property law, all of that is still in its infancy. And they have a different perspective, the Confucius perspective, but they don't have the long history of developing norms of behavior in business relations and customer relations and the importance of goodwill and safety and all of those things are just starting to come around in China. So I think, you know, longer term perspective, I'm very hopeful that the Chinese miracle will continue. But in the short run, we have to be extremely concerned about the instability and the financial imbalances in that massive country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. I just got a tweet from someone today saying, "Nuh-uh, it's just American propaganda that millions of people died under communism." And I'm just shaking my head, you know. I don't know what all propaganda he's reading, but I just came across some kind of propaganda was saying Mao Zedong is the second most violent force in all of human history after World War II, which included Stalin and Hitler. And
yeah,
Mao,
so,
and Chiang Kai-shek, and Japan, and America, and us all. But
Mao's rule was
second place to that.
Yeah, Mao killed people directly. He starved regions. And so millions and millions of people died and suffered under that regime. And their standard of living for the vast majority of the public was a subsistence wage type existence where people barely had enough to survive. And when they were thinking about, you know, coming to terms with the West and meeting with us and making agreements with us, the first group that came over to the United States, they didn't have enough foreign currency reserves in their central bank to pay for the plane tickets from China to the United States. So they were literally a dirt poor country. And so you've got millions of people being outright murdered and killed and others being starved to death. And then the rest of the population suffering enormously with periodic famines and disease that was running rampant because of a very poorly structured medical sector in their economy. So there's been enormous improvements in the standard of living over there. And again, we just have to keep our fingers crossed and hope that the progress over there continues, and we have to hope that that the military balances will stay in check, and that the United States, Japan, and India, and Vietnam can maintain a balance where nobody wants to go to war, nobody wants to get into conflict, because everybody is going to lose as a result. And I think the Chinese understand that. I think the Vietnamese understand that. The Indians and the Japanese understand that. And so that's my hope for the long-run future of that region.
Yep. All right. Now, apologies to the live audience, because I'm just going to keep Mark into the break here. And I'm sorry, I really should have switched to Greece earlier, but the China conversation is so interesting to me and so important. But if I can keep you just a couple of minutes here. And, guys, we'll be right back with David Gibbs in just a minute. But can you talk to me a little bit about what's, you know, a couple most important points, what we need to understand about Greece and the EU?
Well, Greece and the EU, I mean, Greece borrowed an enormous amount of money after they joined the euro, and they were given the seal of approval, and the IMF encouraged them to borrow tons of money. They invested a huge amount of money in solar power, with the idea to provide electricity and carbon credits. Those carbon credits turned out to be worthless or nearly worthless. And so Greece is not in a position to pay off the debt. They can't pay off the debt. They won't pay off the debt. And so we're going to have to move forward with the idea that Greece is bankrupt. Sure, they have a lot of internal problems that that need addressing, but the IMF and the European Central Bank are just saying, okay, just continue to borrow more money. We'll give you more money so that you can pay our banks for loans that the IMF and the European Central Bank condoned in the first place. And so this is going to be a really messy result, whether or not Greece continues to pay and stays in, or whether they drop out and have to find a new currency, something to back their banking system. Either way, it's going to be bad news, but it's really the first inning, the first starting point of the disintegration of the European monetary system, the euro, and even the political alliance of the European community. So this is just the beginning of a lot of trouble going forward, and it's impossible to tell exactly how this is going to work itself out, because all these daily negotiations are just twists and turns in what otherwise is a long-run play of disintegration from the European experiment.
Well, let's just make the Americans bail everybody out, right?
Well, they would like that, and that's the whole idea. Germany has been basically bailing out Greece and the European monetary system. They're the only ones that have a positive balance on their account or of any significance, where everybody else has a negative balance. And so Germany has been subsidizing this whole system with the promise that they're going to get their loans to their banks paid back. Now that they're not going to be paid back, one of the things that will eventually happen will be Germany leaving the euro, or maybe reconstituting the euro with financially sane partners from the northern European area. But the euro looks to be, based on its constitution, something that will eventually disintegrate. And Scott, I just can't tell you if that's going to be in a matter of months or a matter of decades, but it's inevitable.
Yep. All right. I'm sorry we got to stop here, but thanks so much for your time again on the show, Mark. Great to talk to you.
Hey, Scott. It's been great being on here. And everybody come visit me at Mises.org and follow me at Dr. Mark Thornton on Twitter.
Right on. Yeah, you do that, everybody. Mises.org. Thanks, Mark. And we'll be right back.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back. Just in time. Cutting it close here. Yeah, if you guys want to hear the end of that Thornton interview, you'll have to check the archives later on. Had to keep them into the break there. That's how you often do. All right, you guys. So it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network live here weekdays from noon to 2 Eastern. And next up is David Gibbs. And he wrote this article in JacobinMag.com. The Srebrenica precedent. Oh, man, here I go trying to say it. Usually I can say it. Now I'm live on the radio, so I can't. Srebrenica massacre was 20 years ago. And he says here, was a tragic event, but for the last 20 years it's been used to justify more war and U.S. intervention. Welcome to the show, David. How are you?
Fine. Thank you for having me.
Good. Very happy to have you on the show here. And I really appreciate this article. I was too young and not paying attention at the time of this war. I was paying attention by the time of Kosovo in 99. But most of this went by me, and it's such a complicated story. And I have to tell you, I actually have a couple of books about it that I never got around to reading. And and it's always just been kind of a blank spot in my education here about what really led to the war, the Bosnia War in the early 1990s. And not just, oh, well, Yugoslavia broke up, and then everybody started killing everybody and this kind of stuff. But you really take us through step by step. What really happened and what could have been if America hadn't have screwed it up and all that. So could you please tell that story to the people here?
Well, the Yugoslav breakup, I would say, was obviously very complicated. But I think the key one was that you had a sort of economic collapse in the 1980s in a country that had been relatively successful, actually. It was ethnically heterogeneous. No ethnic group really dominated Yugoslavia. But as communism was sort of losing credibility, and in Yugoslavia was doing so in the context of an economic depression, the ethnic groups began sort of engaging in kind of a pathological competition for power. And the Serbs got a lot of attention for engaging in aggressive acts towards other groups. But
I'm sorry, David. I hate to interrupt you here, but if you could. Try to back off the microphone of your phone a bit. The microphone is actually distorting pretty bad, but I can turn you up nice and loud here.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, it's just, it distorts a little bit when you get loud, but so if you can just kind of hold it a little bit further away and try to keep the wind off it, I think.
Is it better at this time?
Just barely. I think maybe at the break we'll try the landline.
How's that?
I guess that's passable. We'll try that at least to the break, and then we'll switch.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
And basically all of the major ethnic groups adopted essentially aggressive and kind of racist policies towards each other, leading to the breakup of the country and a civil war. The Serbs had the advantage of getting most of the weapons in the context of the breakup, and so they did engage in a kind of aggressive war against the other ethnic groups. But none of the ethnic groups behaved especially well. I think what you had was a kind of lobby that went on that was initially Croatians and Bosnian Muslims that hired lobby groups and tried to create the impression that what was going on in Yugoslavia was not just a civil war with massacres, but it was a genocide similar to what the Nazis were doing, a Holocaust, a replay of World War II, which it wasn't. That was a gross exaggeration, but nobody knew anything about Yugoslavia, and so quickly a lot of people, I think, seized upon this as a great moral crusade, and it became a kind of religious fervor associated with the moral crusade. That was phase one. Phase two is you had the United States, which was looking for a new justification for U.S. power after the end of the Cold War. and didn't quite know where to go, and found all of a sudden this very sensational war going on in Yugoslavia. And I think it was included in power circles in Washington and also in Brussels for NATO. But this would be an ideal context in which to re-justify U.S. and NATO power for the post-Cold War era. That, in other words, NATO would no longer fight the Soviet Union, which didn't exist anymore, but NATO would now become a genocide prevention enterprise. And I think that's how it's widely seen by many now, as a genocide prevention enterprise. And it was the war in the Balkans, and particularly the massacre at Srebrenica in 1995, that gave everybody that impression.
And people might not remember now, but in the 90s, it really was kind of a discussion and a controversy whether they were going to have an EU army that would be based, I guess, mostly on the Germans and the French together, and maybe with the British. But the British said, no, no, we got to keep America in. It's all about NATO. We don't want a separate EU army. But this was a real controversy over which way it was going to go back then.
That's another angle to this, is that in the 1990s, there was a real effort by the Europeans, led by the Germans and the French, to try and adopt an independent foreign policy, including an independent military policy, that would, to some extent, be a check on American unilateralism. And that was seen very dimly in Washington, and there was an effort to try and humiliate the Europeans and to undermine any effort they would make at achieving independence. Yugoslavia proved to be the arena of the U.S.-European competition. You see, the U.S. wanted to weaken the EU, but strengthen NATO. NATO was presented as an alternative, really, as a locus of power in Europe to the EU. And again, it played out in the Yugoslav context. Do you want to ask a question, or should I go on with that?
Well, if you could, can we rewind a little bit to the split between the Bosnian Muslims, the Serbs, and the Croats on the ground there? Because the way you described, they had a deal. They were working a deal where, well, go ahead.
Well, what I find very disturbing about the Bosnia case and the Srebrenica case is it's always presented as an iconic event that justifies, first of all, the use of NATO force, that you always have to use force to prevent human rights abuses, including genocide. But simultaneously, one should forego diplomatic efforts to settle conflict, because that shows lack of moral fiber. It's appeasement. And it's claimed that, the Europeans and the United Nations were appeasing the Serbs too long. And that's not really accurate. The fact of the matter is, there probably could have been a diplomatic settlement of the Bosnian War. The whole war probably could have been prevented. The European Union had a preliminary plan for decentralizing power in Bosnia that was accepted by all the major ethnic groups of Bosnia and probably would have prevented the war from even occurring in the first place. And the main thing that prevented this plan from going into effect was that on instructions from Washington, the U.S. ambassador to Yugoslavia, Warren Zimmerman, urged the Bosnian Muslim side and also what would seem the quotes to renege on their commitments and not to go along with the plan. But I guess the implication that the United States would support them in any forthcoming war, and that torpedoed the whole peace plan.
Man.
And war followed very soon. And so I think the main lesson from this is that a diplomacy rather than warfare is a better way of dealing with these types of ethnic conflicts. But that's not the lesson people have learned.
Well, there's a huge lesson there about what they don't tell us about what's going on in the world when they start these wars, too. I mean, the way that you portray this, where the Muslims and the Croats, they had the coalition and the majority, but the Serbs, the odd men out, they were happy with the deal anyway because it provided them with so much autonomy that they didn't mind so much being the minority-ruled party. I mean, this is paradise for the breakup of a multi-ethnic state along lines like this. This is the best bet you could have possibly dreamed of, and America came in and screwed it up.
I think it's basically accurate that, in essence, the Serbs were getting what they wanted, at least at that point in time. And there's really no evidence that they were negotiating in bad faith or that they were bent on war at this point in time. So, yes, I would agree with that assessment.
I mean, that's just amazing. And that's the part of the narrative that no one ever really explained. Okay, here was the deal. It split in three parts.
Mm-hmm.
They had a negotiation. The EU brokered it. It was going to be these two were going to be the coalition. The odd men out were cool with it and celebrated. Their terrible later war criminal leaders celebrated this great deal was going to hold Bosnia together. But then America wanted to keep the European army down and NATO up and the U.S. in and the American taxpayers on the line. And so they ruined it and got a bunch of people killed and then a bunch more mess. And we're going to fix the phone and more details after this.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, guys. So, welcome back to the show. The Srebrenica precedent, it's at jacobinmag.com. The author is David Gibbs. And so, we're going back to 1992, I guess it is. The Europeans had brokered a deal. The Americans came and screwed it up in order to maintain their own interest in the region. A terrible war broke out. I'm not sure how many thousands of people were killed. I guess you can fill us in.
100,000 died.
100,000 people were killed.
Right.
And then came the Dayton Accords, which everybody likes to pat themselves on the back and say, oh, look, us Americans brought peace. Mm-hmm. When, as you explain, it was the Americans' war in the first place, in a sense, in a large sense. In fact, you elaborate in the article how NATO really backed the Croat and Muslim armies against the Serbs.
That's right. That's right.
There for a long time, and including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and them, who were fighting with the Muslims at the time. Isn't that interesting? And then, but the point being, at Dayton, and this is the one thing I've actually been able to learn about this complicated mess in all these years, is that at Dayton, the way Neboj Samalic puts it, is Holbrook came and took a black magic marker and drew hard international borders where there had been kind of these softer lines between the different opposing sides. And what that meant was you had people of all different ethnic and religious factions who were, quote, stuck on the wrong side of the line and had to get to the other side before they got killed. And so that just led to a whole new round of violence and ethnic cleansing after that.
Well, that's right. Basically, you know, in the context of the Bosnia War, the Serbs undoubtedly were the aggressors most of the time. On the other hand, the Bosnians and the Croats also committed atrocities, including some very significant atrocities, fewer than the ones the Serbs committed, but significant all the same. That is a forgotten aspect of this episode. And after the Dayton Accords occurred, the Dayton Accords were preceded by ground offensives by Croatian and Bosnian troops, both in the Republic of Croatia and also in Bosnia, directly supported by the U.S., that resulted in very substantial ethnic cleansing and atrocities against civilians. And then after the Dayton Accords occurred, there was another round of ethnic cleansing, and about 100,000 people were ethnically cleansed. As far as I could tell, NATO did little or nothing to stop it. And it escaped the tension of, you know, world public opinion. You know, the legacy of the Dayton Accords is viewed as this wonderful accomplishment that ended the war, but I think that ignores two things. One is a very similar agreement could have been achieved 3.5 years before, as the Europeans proposed, and would have prevented the war in the first place, but the U.S. stopped it. But also, it was done at the cost of some of the largest rounds of ethnic cleansing the war had seen, done with U.S. support, that helped lay the groundwork for Dayton. And so the Dayton legacy is far less positive, I think, than it's often presented as being.
Yeah, sure sounds like it. All right, so now two big subjects still here to cover, the massacre itself and then the aftermath, as you do such a great job explaining in here the precedent set. So first of all, what happened with the massacre there 20 years ago?
Well, it seems very well documented, and the basic facts aren't in dispute. What happened was that the Bosnian government forces withdrew their main body of defenders from Srebrenica under circumstances that are still mysterious and strongly suggest, at least, that the Bosnian government may have made a decision to to let the city fall. As part of their overall strategy, which was to deliberately expose their own civilians to atrocities in order to increase international outrage and likelihood of intervention, the Serbs undoubtedly were the main perpetrators, and they bear the overwhelming responsibility for the massacre, but the Bosnian government is not altogether innocent here, and they very likely contributed to it as well by not defending their own city. In any case, the Serbs attacked the city, which was largely undefended. They unexpectedly overran it, and then they immediately began undertaking mass atrocities. They expelled the women and children for the most part, and then rounded up thousands of males over the age of 16 and began executing them, executing around 8,000 males over the age of 16, which undoubtedly is a terrible war crime and one that should be punished. It's been called genocide, and I find that problematic. I should add, a lot of legal experts find it problematic. William Shabas of the International Association of Genocide Scholars has questioned it. Robert Hayden at the University of Pittsburgh has questioned it. There are many people who have questioned the designation of this as genocide. It's definitely a major war crime. That's not disputable. But is it genocide on the level of, say, Auschwitz and Treblinka? I think there's a lot of controversy about that particular issue. And so in any case, that is what happened at Srebrenica.
Well, pardon me. Before that, as far as the controversy of what it means, I mean, you talk about this in the article, and pretty frankly here, there's a difference between killing millions of people, at least attempting to eradicate an entire type of person off the planet, an ethnicity or nationality or religious group or something, compared to some real bad, as you say, absolute war crimes, horrible massacre. There's not an apologetic word for it, other than it's just not multiplied by 50,000. And if it was, then we'd be having a different discussion, maybe.
Well, you know, I come out of I have a background as an Africanist, and I began my career studying the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And in the same period, the Congo had a war that killed 4 to 5 million people, which is around 50 times the total number of people killed in Bosnia. And it just seems very arbitrary to me that somehow people focused with this laser-like focus on a single war that by African standards would have been considered a medium-sized war. There's really nothing – the comparison people like to make is the genocide against the Jews in World War II, but it's really not an appropriate comparison. In the areas under Axis control – the vast majority of the Jews were killed off systematically, whereas the percentage of people killed by the Serbs was much smaller than that. In my view, nowhere near what would be required to meet the level of a genocide. So I've always found this designation of genocide a very problematic one, but it serves a political purpose, which is it helps to justify not only U.S. policy in Bosnia, but all U.S. intervention afterwards as a genocide prevention program that's elevated to the level of high principle rather than realpolitik. And that's an enormous advantage if you're an interventionist power. And I think that's a significant factor in why this has been viewed as a genocide as opposed to a war crime.
Yeah, and I mean, you can see the way they've ratcheted down the level of evidence required, where Bill Clinton pretended that 100,000 Kosovar Albanians had been killed in order to justify starting that war in 1999. Obama, fast forward to 2011, he pretends that 100,000 people might be killed if we don't intervene now. And that's a good enough reason not to intervene in one country invading another, which maybe they could invoke some part of the UN charter or whatever. But this is a civil war. That's none of the UN or America's legal business as far as legal cover goes.
Well, I think, you know, you're touching on how this was used, I think, to justify American power and American intervention. And I would say that's the critical factor of interest to me here, which is how this war was simplified in terms of people's understanding of the war into a simple villains and victims narrative that doesn't entirely fit the facts, and one where intervention saved the day and, if anything, caved in too late. And it's been used to justify American intervention in Kosovo. We needed to do it to prevent another Srebrenica. It was, to some extent, done to justify the U.S. war in Iraq. Christopher Hitchens openly said that he supported the war because it prevented another Srebrenica. In Libya, it was invoked. In Syria, it's been invoked. Every time there's a call for intervention, it seems, the Srebrenica precedent is invoked. And I think that's the most pernicious feature of this, that it's a justification for more war, and ignoring all the enormous damage that war does to lives. And so I think that's the main legacy of this, is that they elevated an atrocity into an iconic event as a justification for war intervention by distorting the facts.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you want to talk about, you know, modern precedents, how about Fallujah 1 and 2 in 2004? Mm-hmm. How about, right. You know, the slaughter of Ramadi or whatever, you know, pick. But America, this is why I remember talking to Juan Cole in 2011, and he's all gung-ho for the war in Libya. And I'm going, you know, hey, if you want to lend moral support to the jihadis in Libya, I guess go ahead. But you want the American empire to get involved in Libya after what just happened in Iraq? Right. Are you kidding? But, you know, I guess wishes come true, dreams come true to a certain extent. Except how many Srebrenicas have we had since then in Libya?
Right,
thank God they're not using as an excuse to reinvade that place yet, but... Important point.
Yeah,
anyway, Jacobin Mag for David Gibbs, the Srebrenica precedent. Thanks. Great work. Appreciate the interview.
Thank you very much.
See y'all tomorrow.